I'm Duncan McLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast. We have a very special guest next in the form of Bob Skinstad, the former Springbok flanker and number eight, who is increasingly involved in the world of finance and technology. Bob, it's really great to see you. Thanks for making the time to chat.
No problem, Duncan. Great to see you too.
Now, you retired from professional rugby, according to your Wikipedia page, in November of 2007, so about 13 years now. Maybe take us through some of the things you've been up to since then.
Jeepers, it doesn't feel that long, but now you're making me feel a bit long in the tooth there. I was incredibly lucky to play rugby for a living for a long time, and when 2007 rolled around, I think I was quite ready to do some other stuff. Although I sort of bridged the professionalism and amateur era, which meant that I had to sort of get on and do other stuff anyway, mm-hmm. and sort of keep myself busy and at least understand sort of working post rugby, etc. So I had I'd been dabbling in a few things by the time I got back. I'd done some independent work. I'd had a break in my career. So I'd worked for Saatchi and Saatchi Ad Agency. So I was quite excited about getting out into the workplace. And I got back to Cape Town, took a few months to sort of find my feet and I went into various work roles. I bought into a little hospitality business. I did some charity stuff and I suppose threw a few irons into the fire. As always, there are things you learn, there are things you do again, there are things you wouldn't, but it probably took me two or three years to carve out a space with, a venture capital firm, Knife Capital. I was very lucky to have gone to university with one of the founders, Keith Van Sale.
Oh, yes.
I got on very well with the rest of the team, knew them. They've got a very specific set of skills in the sort of early and venture stage startup space, which was a space that I was excited about. I think I was South Africa's first subscriber to Fast Company magazine when I was a rugby player, because I found it at an airport on a trip to Houston in 2001. Probably much too expensive to ship just one copy of those kind of things. So it cost me a lot, but it kept me up to date with what was happening on the other side of the world. And then obviously, as you started to read those kind of things online and granted, it was clearly a space that I enjoyed. We've got a system which is find, make, grow and then realize, which has got to do with exit. I'm probably on the grow side, using some of my network and connections to join up some dots, introduce some people to some opportunities, create some market access where there wasn't, etc. So I've sort of fitted into the team there. We've raised some funds together. And because I had a little bit of time to sort of do some corporate work in South Africa and dot the I's and cross the T's on what I knew about running a business, I've been able to use that with these guys in a semi-leadership role now. And I came over to the UK. We sold a portion of that business into a family office here. So my email address reflects Draper Gain now, which is the family office that I've been working for 4 years. But Draper Gain wholly owns Knife Capital. So it's been sort of one linear movement. Draper Gain is a family office that's got various investments. They had some investments before I arrived, and we've taken on some in the journey. And then obviously all of the investments of Knife Capital fall under that. So we've got an office here in London. We've got one in Cape Town, and we've got representation through an office and some staff in Jersey. So we try and invest money from around the world in the various things that we do. But I concentrate mainly on the startup stuff. The Knife Capital stuff with the team of Keith Van Sale and Andrea Bowman, who are Cape Town based.
Great stuff. Do you keep in contact with the rugby world? Are you still involved in any way in the rugby fraternity?
Yeah, I do. I mean, not so much commentary anymore. I've put that on hold for a bit, only because my kids are growing up and Saturday has become more precious. The under nine B team netball and athletics and hockey and rugby and whatever it is of one of my four kids is usually more important to me than watching or commentating on a premiership game over here. I was lucky to be able to do both. I'd love to get more into the rugby, and I think post COVID I'll probably do a bit more, but I've been in a phase where I sort of put that on hold so that I could I could, you know, watch my kids growing up. I think what I did do to my benefit was on big tours, so World Cups and big tours, I would take a role either with the BBC or with Sky or with SuperSport and at least contribute. So I've kept involved. I'm not doing any coaching or anything like that. I do some work coaching and match managing in cricket, actually, in the juniors, which I love. So sports have been a huge part of my life. It hasn't gone away. It remains a big part of it. But professional rugby and professional coaching is not something I'm involved in.
No. Okay. Something I wanted to ask you is I've often wondered about professional rugby players and what they do post their professional careers. Now, you've built a successful business career now. Do you think your rugby career has helped you in some way to establish your career post professional rugby? And I guess the reason I'm asking this is do the rugby networks help rugby players further their ambitions? I imagine that a lot of pro rugby players start playing at school. It's all they focus on. They play through their 20s. Everything is about rugby, and then at a point they reach a certain age where they have to retire. And I imagine a lot of those rugby players who come through the system aren't necessarily ready for what comes next. Are there support structures in place? Does SA Rugby help rugby players think about what they're going to do once they retire from pro rugby?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, and it's well phrased, because you're right that one, they don't have time, but two, their focus is different. You know, you become a celebrity or a media personality. You're constantly giving your time to other people, to whether it's the fans or your teammates and the coaching structures, etc. As a player, I think the unions have got programs in place. You know, they do support the players, but they can't really support the players to their own detriment. So you know, it's I also think rugby is very young like that. We moved from amateur to professional in 1995. You know, baseball's been professional for 100 years. So there's going to be more movement towards that. I think I've seen good work from Rugby Players Association over here, the Rugby Players Association in South Africa is well managed and contributed to by the players. There's a couple of sort of, I would say, almost charity-like movements over here. Switch the Play Foundation, which concentrates on sportsmen and women coming out of their careers and moving into a sort of a corporate environment or a job environment. Are they prepared? How can we help them prepare? They teach them sort of after dinner speaking, whether it's the skills that you need to join a corporation, you know, even just administration skills of your life type thing. Yeah. So there are programs that help. I think I would imagine the journey is more difficult now because players get picked up younger.
Yes.
Sort of plucked out of a school program almost and then into sort of the needs of whatever senior rugby group that they're part of and they don't really get the opportunity. I mean, I've only heard of two or three young players that I know now that are really pushing back against the structures and saying, I want to study, I want to get my degree and I want to be part of a university environment, etc. And I think that's great. You know, Pat Lamby springs to mind, Francois Lowe. These are guys who've gone on and done their qualifications while they were playing, you know, and made a focus on it and been able to contribute and have subsequently launched businesses and careers. So it's a hugely important thing to me. But I think it's probably an underserved part of what professional sport does.
Yeah, interesting. Was that the Loch Ness monster that just floated behind you?
It could well be. It could well be. This is actually really funny. I'm trying out. It's an application invented by the guy who started Evernote. You know, the note taking company.
I do. Yeah.
Phil Libin. Yeah. So this is his newest project, and I'm a beta tester.
What is it?
It's called the app is called Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
MMHMM, because he wants to he wanted to have a name for a company that he could say while he was eating at work. he's a developer, and he was like, I don't want to have to announce it or pronounce it while people are coming up to me and I'm eating at work. I mean, I don't know, that name for me it sticks, But it's a really cool application. There's lots of different things you can do. I mean, you can, I can make myself disappear and reappear, at will. I can chuck in pictures behind me. Let me see if I can chuck anything in behind me now.
I'm definitely going to have to download this and try it out, Bob.
Yeah, it's great. I'll send you an early invite. But I'm not trying to hijack what we're talking about. But I'm playing with this now because I think it might be one of the features of broadcast. You know, if I can do what you need a 20 million rand studio in Randburg on my desktop. Then the future might be more focused towards this than other stuff.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. I'll try it out. So it's in closed beta at the moment. Are you an investor in it?
I am through Knife Capital, through our early stage. We're an investor, but it was so oversubscribed that we probably won't even feature on the cap table. We're a few cents in the dollar compared to the big American money. But you know what? We're a beachhead market, and they want to get into Africa and tech and all those kind of things. So we're going to try and use that to help as much as we can.
Yeah. As a matter of interest, you mentioned the American money market, and I'm amazed at the amount of money sloshing around the U.S. system at the moment, despite what's going on in the world with COVID and all the rest of it. What do you make of where the NASDAQ is, the fact that NASDAQ is touching new highs every day, that the fact that there's so much money sloshing around the system? Do you think this is sustainable, or do you think we're heading for a crash?
Look, far be it from me to predict the future, but I certainly believe some of your statement is correct. The sustainability has to be questioned.
We
looked at the 2008 crash and the housing market, and only a few people turned around and said, surely this isn't sustainable, pre-crash. Everybody else was like, oh, this is great. I can get a mortgage on a house that I've never even seen before. And, let's just keep going and let's get bigger. It's very human to think like that. So I think everybody who has picked up a few cents or a few dollars of any of the FANG stocks, yeah, will go, well, I'm a really smart investor. If you've been a futurist pre-COVID, you would have said, well, what's going to accelerate the adoption of all of the online behemoths, whether it's home delivery or interaction with Microsoft or Google or whatever it is. And that's going to be, a full on lockdown where nobody can get out. And we suddenly our stimulus is going to come from our screen. And that's happened, so they are going to race away for a while. But I also think they're going to race away, and the Robin Hoods of the world are going to get sort of completely underqualified investors chasing fairy dust. Mm. So the pessimists, I believe, need to be heard now, and I'm listening very intently to people who've been sort of negative in the past and been right. I'm reading up as much as I can about those guys. I've moved a lot of money out of stocks because I just I can't predict what's happening next. But it's also the world changes. The world changes, and the more it changes, the more it stays the same. We're going to make mistakes. There are going to be cycles. There's going to be up and down.
Yeah, it really does start. It is starting to look, maybe not to the same level as the .com bubble in 2000 yet, but certainly in some of the bigger cap stocks, some of the valuations are looking a little bit insane, like Tesla, for example.
And maybe if you look at Tesla's PE right now, over 100. That was maybe a sort of fairy tale stock in 2008 of pets.com when people didn't know what the hell was going to come of it because they just believed the hype, and I'm certainly not a naysayer about Tesla. I think Elon Musk's doing an amazing job of innovating and pushing the boundaries, but he's pretty much out there on his own in terms of the thought leadership, so people are buying into the bubble around it. Tesla's a tech stock. It's not a car stock. It's a car manufacturer, but it's 100% a tech stock because he's gonna use those routes to move into a million different things, and he's already doing it, and he's already doing it fast.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great South African guy has done incredible stuff. But yeah, that share could indeed be grossly overvalued. So Bob, what does your average day entail now? Maybe take us through what you do between breakfast and dinner, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, sure. No problem. I've got four little kiddies and we live in a town called Weybridge. Luckily, most mornings I can walk my kids to school at the moment during COVID.
Nice.
I could probably do that 2 days a week, you know, when we're going into the office. My commute from here is about a 35-minute train. I can walk up to the station, 35-minute train into Waterloo, and then I walk a lot. I believe in walking because I don't always get a chance to exercise as much as I would. And I think we get quite sedentary in our old age. Rugby players are well known to be guys who are standing around the braai with much too much girth. So I try not to be that, and I walk a bit and stay active. So if I can, I walk the kids to school, and then, you know, we have a daily catch up with our various teams. We've got a fundraising team that I'm part of, and we've got a management team that I'm part of. We also weigh in on the various businesses. We've got different roles depending on which businesses are meeting and sort of assessing strategy. I help on new business development as well. So I'll break my day up at the moment between, you know, I would say Zoom and Teams and Google Meets in meetings. Mm-hmm. Pre-COVID, I would have done that from the office, but then had in-person connections with my team. I'm very lucky. The CEO of our family office lives in Weybridge as well. So nice. Most days at about 3 p.m., I'll walk to his house, and we'll have a sort of a post day catch up. We have a meeting with some of the team, and then we'll sort of work out what we need to do for the next 3 days. Yep. In that. And then if I can, at about 5 o'clock, my son and I try and play either, you know, nine holes, or there's a golf range quite close to us. So hit some balls or go for a walk, or some of the evenings I play five-a-side football.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So you've been in the UK for 4 years now. Do you see yourself staying there? Will you come back to South Africa at some point?
Yeah, we'll definitely be back in South Africa, you know, for holidays and visiting family, etc. But I think we've committed to living here for now. A lot of our businesses in South Africa, the extension of those businesses is here. So someone's got to manage this side of it. We love South Africa to bits. I've still got a house and a half, I like to say it, because my parents-in-law have kept a small house in Cape Town, which we use when we're there, and I've got a house down in the Eastern Cape. So, you know, we visit those, and I've probably done almost all the Christmases since I've been here in South Africa. And in fact, we were supposed to go back as a family for Easter. You know, we miss grannies and grandpas very much, and the kiddies do in particular. So I try and take them back and spend that family time. But also our businesses are there. I believe in the entrepreneurs there. I believe in the system in South Africa supporting entrepreneurs. I think great ideas are coming out of there. They need to internationalize, and we've positioned ourselves to be a safe pair of hands to help them internationalize, grow them obviously locally, get as big as they can, and internationalize as they grow.
Now, you obviously talk to a lot of investors, potential investors in London. Perhaps we don't get a real view, being based here in South Africa, of what the rest of the world is thinking about the country. We've got a lot of challenges here. We've got load shedding. The economy is in a terrible state, obviously made a lot worse by the lockdown we've just been through. But in your discussions, in your meetings and interactions with investors in London, what is the perception of both South Africa as a country and an investment destination, as well as some of the potential investments in terms of startups that are coming out of this country?
Geez, I mean, that's a big question. I'll try and break it down for you. So in terms of the startups coming out of South Africa, still very positive. People believe we've got good, solid talent. We've got hardworking individuals. We've got people with a very well-tuned global view, you know, people who can grow. We you know, South Africa is a great picture for what the world can be like. If you look at downtown Joburg, or it's called a financial district, Joburg, or in the middle of sort of corporate Cape Town, if you want, you could be in any city in the world. You know what I mean? It's very much like what you could replicate parts of San Fran, you could replicate parts of Tokyo, you know, parts of London. So people are confident that the entrepreneurs are globally attuned and have a pretty good view of the world. So they trust them. You know, there's been a few studies that have come out, you know, in Australia and Canada, South Africa punches way above his weight in terms of exported talent in middle management. So you know, we are naturally good leaders who work in corporate businesses. So that's very positive on the people side. And then obviously those people lead good businesses. And you know, we've just had a fantastic validation or verification, if you want, of that from a strategic investor coming into a South African startup of our group, Data Profit. It's an engineering business, autonomous AI. I mean, it's groundbreaking, but it's coming out of Cape Town. You know, this is not a Silicon Valley business, which is started there and trying to, you know, sort of stay there and then go to the rest of the world. This is a South African focused business, and they've shown us the faith in that business. Then there's the sort of outside view, just looking in, and you spoke about the negativity around, you know, one lockdown and our treatment of COVID. There's also negativity here. You know, Boris Johnson's in the papers every day being castigated by, you know, whoever his political rival is that week that's shouting the loudest about what, you know, his decisions were for lockdown. I mean, it's a thankless task in that space. I do think that there is a bit of negativity about South and Southern Africa now because of possibly the, let's just say the lack of moving forward on promise. You know, post sort of Mandela-esque statesmen, the world was like, wow, you know, now here's the new dawn of Africa. South Africa can lead that. We can actually do this right. And you know, we've had our leaders in our country stand by in an apathetic manner. You know, whether it's looting at government level and the news that we get every day of mismanagement, etc. But it does filter out. You know, the rest of the world's like, yeah, look, I really like South Africa, good people, etc. Would I invest in South Africa? Probably not. You know, can you bring the investment out? Can we invest here? So we get a lot of those questions. We get a lot of questions about, you know, I'm definitely not investing in IP in South Africa, but if you can bring the company to Amsterdam or Delaware or somewhere where I start to trust, you know, the legalities of protecting the IP, then I'm interested. So it's a bit of a 50-50. You know, we can help engineer opportunities around those hurdles, but they're still hurdles. You know, it's not like saying I'm raising money in Silicon Valley. There's no questions. It's like, you know, you've got a bank account local, you've got engineers developed local, you've got a product developed local, and you've got probably people with reputation working in your business. We have to set that standard first before people are willing to invest, you know. So luckily we've as Knife Capital, the team have had some incredible wins and exits and internationalization of opportunity. So people are coming to us still and saying, okay, you know, there is investment in Africa. You know, hold our hand through it. Tell us what to look for. Tell us how to mitigate risks. You know, what should we be doing in a sort of a quasi sort of quasi corrupt state? Like, how do you manage it? And we're always trying to say, listen, it will be right as long as we can. The area where we operate in, which is probably reporting mainly to Saab and SARS, you know, those kind of, I think those have been incredibly well run. Yes. You know, like SARS was best in class. And for us, we've got a 12J fund in South Africa. So, you know, that's stimulating the economy. It's doing all the right things. And so are a lot of the other funds, but immediately there are people looking for loopholes and trying to tweak the laws to benefit themselves. You know, so it's difficult because you're always working with people who are looking over their shoulder and saying, you know, is there something that I'm being duped on? You know, is the wool being pulled over my eyes? So it ends up being part of our job to try and manage that expectation.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, there's historically been a lot of goodwill towards South Africa from the UK. Do you think we're at risk potentially of squandering that?
Yeah, look, it is a risk. I think there has been goodwill towards South Africa by and large. I think South Africa, and I'm not sure whether it's because, you know, maybe it's because we've been sort of a country that has impacted others in terms of our production, you know, or we were a colonial state, we were part of the great empire, etc. So we always sort of little bits about South Africa flitted through on the BBC. So everyone had an opinion, but might not have been there. You know, so we've become almost part of the vernacular, part of the furniture, if you want, in the conversations about Africa. Mm-hmm. South Africa is hugely important to people of the UK and sort of global superpowers. I think we are at risk of suddenly falling out of the Africa and South Africa conversation into South Africa as just part of Africa and, you know, what do we do there? I mean, there's lots of African countries which are rising, you know, faster or running away from us in terms of reputation. You know, if you look at the impacts that I suppose some of the tech businesses, some of the data plays, some of the sort of the African focused investments, you know, the biggest ones are Nigerian and Kenyan and you know, South Africa used to run number one on all of those. You know, now we have to compete with a couple more players out there. So we are in danger, I think, of slipping down the rung, you know, but we've also got a very, very powerful group of entrepreneurs and we've got a lot of people who believe in South Africa. You know, we work closely with Ketso Gordon from the SASME Fund. They took a while to get going, but he was then appointed and he's making investments. He's putting money into funds that are putting money into businesses. He's putting pressure on people to advance black owned businesses that are businesses of, you know, of excellence. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not allowing, washing of the rules. He's really sticking to them and saying, let's stimulate the economy. And I think that's good for South Africa, you know, but I'm not sure that message is being told enough.
Sure. You mentioned the rest of Africa. Is that, are there businesses? Are you looking at the Kenyan and Nigerian markets as knife capital? Do you have representations up there? Is it something that you're going to look at in the future?
Look, traditionally the rule for knife capital was, we don't invest anywhere where we can't get to the head of the business within a day.
Okay.
And you know, that sort of precludes us doing overnight travel to somewhere. So we stayed away from Asia and you know, where we couldn't get to people easily, we didn't invest. But we've moved outside of our borders. We've got businesses who we've helped move outside our borders. We don't have office representation, but we've got partnerships with funds that have got offices in countries like that. And for our sort of our international fund, our Series B, we are saying South Africa and interesting businesses and opportunities within Africa. So, you know, we're definitely starting to move there. It's not our focus, but we are not going to say no to interesting opportunities with good leaders, with good business models, in Africa as a whole, because we believe that we can help those businesses and we can internationalize their product offering and we can make sure they're ready to take the next step.
Maybe just to tell us a bit about Knife Capital's investment focus. What sort of companies are you looking to invest in and why?
Well, I think traditionally Knife Capital has been let's say small to medium VC. So we've invested in businesses that are innovation driven. We look for good management teams. We look for good product market fit. We look for a beachhead market in South Africa that can be internationally, transferred. That can be scaled. That can be sent overseas. If you look at our successful businesses, we've proved the business model in our own backyard, and then we've either sold the business to, you know, a company that wants to advance it themselves internationally, or we've collaborated with partners and grown internationally with businesses. So, in our current portfolio, we've got a little bit of a focus on education technology. We've got an investment in a business called Snaplify, which has recently won some work with the Kenyan government. So already there, that sort of cross-border work is happening. In those businesses, we've got a sort of a huge focus on being sustainable without having to only win government contracts. We're looking to go into school and education systems. Private schools in South Africa are a great marker. You know, the private school system in Australia and in Canada is very similar to that of South Africa. So then we can replicate outside of our borders. And if we can prove that in South Africa, we think we can move it internationally. So that innovation, and you know, there is a tech focus. We're not always only about the tech. The innovation might be like in Pura Soda, which is probably not a business that people would say technically an innovation business. We say it is an innovation because they are leaders in the low sugar movement. You know, they are independent, you know, very smart guys from Coca-Cola, InBev, Red Bull backgrounds who've come together and said, you know, let's innovate in terms of how we market a lower sugar drink that is sort of in the mixer type space, and let's look to grab as much space in that market as we can, and they're leading incredibly well. It's a business that's certainly not short of gumption and attitude and enthusiasm, and you know they've arrived in the UK. So we focus on a combination of those management teams, the innovation, transferable IP if possible, and definitely businesses that can scale internationally.
Yeah, great, Bob. It's been a fascinating discussion. Maybe let me ask you before I go, what you see yourself doing over the next, say, 5 to 10 years? Where do you see your career going? Obviously growing with Knife Capital, but what do you want to achieve going forward? And I know it's a tough question to ask.
Yeah, it is a tough question. I think about it a lot. I mean, we've had time on our hands in this COVID period, haven't we? I think I would really like to assess all the things that are going to affect me for the next 30 years. And then focus on the best version of that for me for the next 10. So then I can let it manifest out. You know, I want to be able to spend time with my kids and my family. I want to make good investment decisions. I do want more people to fall in love with Africa and the Africa that I know, because I think it's an amazing opportunity for people to have pride in themselves and where they came from and take others back and show them. So I can't wait to do that for a lot of people. And I think the best way for me to do that is to do it through showing that we are investing in and growing South African businesses. So if I can get better and better and better at that, then fantastic. If I can lean gently into maybe some of the exciting sports related venture startups out of South Africa over the next 10 years, then I'm going to do that. You know, I think a couple of them have still got to prove their business models to me, but I'm excited about finding more. I think there's some really cool entrepreneurs and good connected people in that space that we can back going forward.
Excellent. And hopefully soon we'll be able to watch some real life sports again too.
I hope so. In fact, talking about that, the Lions are on next year, and I'm really hoping to bring a whole bunch of English people to watch the Springboks smash them at stadiums in South Africa. It'll be great fun.
Good to see your loyalty still live with South Africa.
Don't worry about that.
Excellent. Well, Bob Skinstad, thank you so much for making the time to talk to Tech Central today. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.